Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast Roundtable, coming up with Neil Best of Newsday and John Orand of the Sports Business Daily and Journal. We talk about what we think the Patriots-Eagles Super Bowl will be as a viewership play, and where does the Super Bowl stand right now in terms of will it be up or will it be down in the number of viewers that will exist in 2018. We get into chat about the Olympics and the, I would say, lack of buzz this year in terms of potential viewership. Some other conversations about Thursday night football and the coverage of USA Gymnastics and the scandal that has existed in that organization, culminating with just the horrific news from the Larry Nassar hearing. And we discuss some why journalists were late to get to that story and the coverage that really needs to exist heading forward. So a lot of sports media talk coming up on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. It is Monday, and that means Roundtable Day. Our guest this week, John Orand, the fine sports media writer of Sports Business Daily and Sports Business Journal, and Neil Best, the general columnist and sports media writer for Newsday. Gentlemen, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Neil, sorry. I thought it was Neil Worst, Richard.
Neil, should we get it? Let's just get into that right away so we get it off the top. A local, I guess he might be known nationally. Michael Kay is the broadcaster for the Yankees, but he's also a local sports talk host. He competed against Francesa for many years. And somehow he thought, and the irony of this is you really are more of a down-the-middle guy than I think most people in the business are. He somehow thought, I guess, you were riding Francesa's coattails or favoring Francesa for all these years, and he dropped this is like something out of like a bad schoolyard taunt. But instead of calling you Neil Best, he called you Neil Worst on the air.
Well, yes, and ever since then, all my friends and colleagues have been calling me Worst also. Like, it's every text. It's like, hey, Worst, what are you doing today? And that kind of thing. Yes, Michael believes that I am biased in favor of Mike Francesa, and he, when my name came up on his show a couple weeks ago, someone called me Neil Best, and he corrected him and said Neil Worst, and so it has been ever since. It's better than being ignored, I guess, and I'm not offended. I just spell the name right, or in this case, spell the alternative name right.
Well, here's the two things. I've been on Kay's show. I like Michael Kay. I've met him in person. I find him to be a decent guy, so this surprises me. He does, in my opinion, he's a little too, and I guess you can understand it given the competition, a little too deep in the woods with this whole Francesa stuff. So I think he's overreacting here, because as someone who has read the New York sports media columnists for decades, compared to Raceman and Mushnick, you more than those guys have always, in my opinion, been, you've played the Francesa ratings and Francesa and his competition very down the middle.
I mean, I've pointed out to Michael many, many times, I have no rooting interest in this ratings race that it's over now, that he used to have with Francesa, and I just don't care on a personal level about this. But Michael has admitted on the air many times that he can be sensitive and thin-skinned at times, and I think that this might have been one of those times. But we have a very cordial, I saw him on Friday when I was doing a story, and he... we had a very cordial interaction. He just chooses not to be interviewed by me and to call me Neil Worst on the air, but I'm not offended. Well, I'm not offended by the Neil Worst thing. I would like for him to subject himself to interviews like anybody with me, but so far we're kind of on hold in that area. But it's fine. Like I said, it beats being ignored.
Yeah, all right, so we're going to call you Neil Best for this
podcast. You'd be okay. Like I said, everybody else has made the transition, but you can go back to Best if you want.
Yeah, I'm going. Neil Best will be the name. And I must say, obviously, given that Maggie Gray is my former colleague and a friend, I'm wishing her well. Not that I wish the K-Show ill will, but I really hope that those guys at least maintain a lot of Francesa's audience, just so she keeps that job for a while. But let's move past. I mean, this is not New York sports talk, Neil.
Wait a minute. You're saying there are other cities in America?
Yes.
Tell me more about this.
John Orand.
I wasn't aware of this.
He can tell you all about Baltimore and Washington.
Oh, okay. All right. Fine. You know, last night the Empire State Building had the colors of the Patriots and the Eagles on to celebrate their victories. I'm like, wow, that's pretty bold for... I guess that means New York's, not just its own city. It's the capital of the world. If we have to put these other hated cities' colors Lakers on the Empire State Building.
Is this the worst possible matchup for a New York Super Bowl?
There is that. That is sort of the working theory going on today. I mean, I'm not sure I buy that because the Eagles thing. You know, you could argue the same thing about the Redskins or Cowboys. I think maybe more so the Cowboys, but since they're so close, I guess it kind of is actually.
All right,
so it is the worst.
Let's get back on. This has become like New York sports. So let's get back on track, Neil. First of all,
okay, fine. There's other cities. I acknowledge it. Go ahead.
Stop producing the show. Let's go to John Oran, and here's where I want to start. And I will get to you, Neil, as well. I am interested in John, your initial thoughts as to how you think a Patriots Eagles Super Bowl will play. We're talking two top 10 television markets, which obviously is always a huge thing for the NFL. The downside, of course, is there could be some Patriots fatigue. We all know that the NFL ratings this year have not been good. And we just, as I'm taping this, we saw the overnights for the championship games. The Jags-Patriots, I think, is a great story for the NFL. Just a shade or tick off last year's number, which I think, given this environment, is great, especially since Jacksonville is a small market. And then, obviously, the Falcons. Obviously, the Eagles-Vikings number. Not the greatest for the championship game, but that was a blowout. So as you project, John, 2 weeks forward, what's your just sort of top-line initial thoughts on how viewership interest in a Patriots-Eagles Super Bowl?
But if you view the NFL season as a TV series, you know, it's really unlikely that at the end, for the cliffhanger, you're going to get all these people that haven't been sampling the game throughout the season. So throughout the season, the games are down close to 10% generally across the board. I think you've seen the same through the playoffs. The Super Bowl is a little bit different because Super Bowl is like, it's sort of like the national holiday, and you build parties around that, and you get a lot of viewership around that. But I would not at all be surprised to see it drop, you know, what, 5%, 6%, regardless of who's in there. I think if it had been Jacksonville instead of New England, it probably would have dropped a little bit more than that, because I do think some the market sizes do matter. But I would not be surprised, and I would predict, regardless of whether it's a good game or not, that the ratings are going to be down for this year.
Neil?
Well, I think that, John, I agree with the general point that John made, but specifically in terms of Patriots fatigue, I would disagree with that, only in that that's become this, you know, two-decade-long almost now sort of saga, and, you know, they're obviously now at the point where you either love them or hate them, most of the country in the hate category, but as we know, whether it's Mike Francesa or a lot of other things, love and hate are both good compared to indifference. So I do not think there is Patriots fatigue to the extent that it would cause people not to watch, because some people will watch to see them win, and many, many people will watch to see if they finally lose.
John, it's interesting. I had this discussion with Robert Seidman, and now I forget who was on. Maybe it was Kruppi on his podcast, Robert Seidman Sports TV Ratings Podcast, a couple weeks ago. And we contemplated this idea of what would happen if the Super Bowl drew under 100 million viewers and how major a story that would be. What I think the Patriots winning their game, John, absolutely guarantees is that that story is not going to happen. You may be right. You know, we may see 108 million, 109 million. I have to look at the numbers a little bit. But the Eagles bring a lot of people in, so I'm not sure. But that's the one thing that I do think New England winning that game ensures, is that we're not going to see some kind of 15, 20% drop. You know, the Super Bowl gets 98 million instead of 111 million, and we have to read for like three straight weeks how like football's dying in America.
Yeah, but we are going to see that drop. It is going to, if you take a look at the trend lines, it's going to be under 100 million at some point in the next few years. I mean, that's where the whole TV industry is going. That's where the TV market's going. But I think that if you're a TV network, an audience of, let's say, 78 million is huge. An audience of 80 million, that's huge. So like it would have to really sink like a rock for this to be something that is really, really concerning for a TV network.
interesting.
Obviously, we're also obviously adjusting to new world of how people consume things and how it's measured. I mean, I thought it was very interesting at the pre-Olympics, pre-Super Bowl media event that NBC had last week that Mark Lazarus just flat out said the TV ratings for the Olympics will be down. Now, maybe that's setting low expectations, but it's also a recognition of the changing landscape and how many people are going to watch their streams, and well, of course, they're measuring that also. But I mean, this whole measuring business obviously has gotten so much more complicated that even if the Super Bowl drops, you know, that doesn't mean people aren't consuming it in some way.
You know, John, it's interesting you say that because maybe I'm naive here, but I think it's going to take. It's going to take some time still to go under 100 million. You think that when you say that's going to happen, is your near term like 3 to 5 years, or is your near term 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, but it's right around 5 years is what I would put it. I mean, it's all matchup driven. I, of course, was somebody that thought that ratings were going to increase in the NFL this year. So, you know, this is an out there prediction. But you have right now in the whole TV market, like people just aren't getting together to watch this stuff, and the increases that we saw, you know, you're going to see more people streaming it. You're going to see more people just, you know, not watching it. I think, and it is going to drop.
Neil, one thing just before I forget, I want to get you on this. I think it's obviously smart for Mark Lazarus, the head of the NBC Sports, to get ahead on Olympic ratings. Rather than just say, I think we're going to be down, did he give a reason as to why that is, either time difference? To me, and again, it's only January 22nd, and people really seem to only get excited about the Olympics the week before it starts. But I'm not sure we've ever had a Winter Olympics with less ready-made stars coming in, especially with the NHL not playing this year.
Oh, yeah, they've got the NHL problem. They have the lack of, you know, star women U.S. figure skaters. I mean, there's a lot of things going against them. The time zone is actually, you know, better than Europe. It's worse than North America, but better than Europe. So they are going to show a lot of stuff live. But I think he was talking strictly in terms of the TV component. I mean, they're going to measure everything, and they expect their streaming stuff to be fine. But, you know, the TV component is going to gradually drift away. I mean, I know this isn't shocking to you guys, but I think it is to a lot of people, certainly of my generation. But I mean, I have daughters who are 22 and 20, and it really, I guess I feel personally this phenomenon of millennials, of TV just not existing in their world. Like, television just isn't part of their world. They just consume stuff absent television. So, you know, these, obviously the whole world is going to have to adapt to a new way of figuring out what people are watching.
All right,
and I think what's interesting about that is that if you talk to people in leagues, like if you talk to people in the NFL, they're freaking out a lot more than television executives, because television executives still see sports as you know, it's not dropping any faster than entertainment programming. In fact, it's ratings are dropping a lot slower than entertainment programming, and sports is still the one area where people have to watch it live. I mean, that's now a cliche, but it's true, and it's where the ad dollars are going. So I think that the TV network executives are seeing some of these drops, and you know they're not freaking out about them. I think that if you're in the league and you're just used to everything going up, up, and up, then it becomes a lot more concerning.
Yeah, and actually, Kruppi made that point not too long ago. Anthony Kruppi of Ad Age, who said that the dollars into the NFL this year are still excellent. So while the ratings obviously have taken a hit, the advertising interests are still mega high. And again, I think we all agree on this. Those who bet against the NFL getting rights increases usually lose. Maybe this will be the one time it happens. I can't see it. I want to switch to the Olympics.
Like, amplify that point, like, do you want to advertise in Big Bang Theory, where a lot of people DVR it or watch it on demand and skip right through the commercials? I mean, it's a much tougher sell to advertisers than, hey, you want to watch this NFC Championship game. Even though ratings may be down, everybody that's watching it is watching it live.
Neil, did you want to add anything?
No, I mean, that's obviously true that sports is still the gold standard, but, you know, it's going to slip. But, yeah, as long as it slips less quickly than everything else. You know, when I say millennials aren't interested in TV, obviously millennials who are sports fans are still stuck to watch television live. So in terms of entertainment programming, you know, again, having 22- and 20-year-old daughters, that television just is not. They have screens where they live, but not actual normal television connections.
Let's talk about the Olympics if we can for a little bit. I saw Ben Fisher, John, your colleague, who wrote an item about NBC Olympics host Mike Tirico saying he would not get into politics at the games the way Bob Costas did. And I thought that was pretty interesting in that you can, in my opinion, while NBC always tries very hard to escape the nexus between politics and the Olympics, it's such a naive and maybe even, I mean, fraudulent's probably too hard, but it's an absurd kind of play to me. The fact is politics exist in the Olympics. We're seeing that with the North Korea-South Korea combined team. We see drugs paramount in terms of an Olympic story. Just look at the Russians, obviously, not competing under their flag. I can't recommend the documentary Icarus enough. It basically will change how you think about the Olympics. So, John, let's start with you. What'd you think of that? I mean, I know NBC wants to make this cotton candy and sunshine and applesauce, and that sort of always historically bothers me. It's the same thing I'm bothered when I see Billy Bush interviewing Ryan Lochte in Rio.
You know, Bob Costas used to take almost delight in going and standing in Beijing and Tiananmen Square and sort of talking about the political unrest there, or, you know, in Russia when he did that. So I think a lot of people can read into what Tirico said as sort of throwing shade into Costas. I think his quote was like, people aren't tuning into the Olympics to see me, which is you could read as Bob thought people were turning into the Olympics to see Bob. But I think if you take a look at Tirico's history and career, he doesn't get into this stuff at all. I mean, and to have him sort of start doing it at the Olympics is, you know, would be asking him to, you know, have a different way of presenting than he's presented in his entire career, and it wouldn't be authentic, and it wouldn't be him. So I think the key for NBC is who are they going to have to fulfill Costas's role, and are they going to have anybody who would fulfill that role? Because it's not going to be Tirico, and it probably shouldn't be Tirico, because that's not his style.
It seems like what they'll do is they'll kick it to the news side. Neil?
Well, a lot of what Costas did in terms of politics would have been more like opening ceremonies as opposed to when he's just throwing it to the figure skating competition. I mean, to me, look, I understand it's the Olympics, and it's kind of the surrounding story is always a part of the story of the Olympics. However, I do think once the competition starts, it's almost like with Super Bowls, where the people who go to the game or cover the game remember the Super Bowls I covered based on what city they were in. But as a viewer, it's just a game that's on my television screen. And I think for the most part, once those primetime competitions start, viewers sort of forget where it is. It's just a figure skating competition on a rink. So, you know, you really got to pick your spots with the politics stuff, because for the most of the time, it's just not relevant to the viewing experience for the people who want to watch these competitions.
I understand that. And I think within the game, within the competition itself, I get that. I guess in the end, we'll just sort of see how NBC covers stuff outside of the actual event. You know, I think what even bothers me more about NBC's coverage than the news side, and a lot of times we have some very good news people who are there, it's the today showization of the Olympics. And there's such an obsession, or there has been in my opinion, to get, and this is where I brought up Billy Bush, to get the Billy Bushes and the Natalie Moraleses and the Matt Lauers and the Savannah Guthries into, like, your coverage somehow. Katie Couric is doing the opening ceremony. I think Katie Couric is obviously a step above the people who I mentioned in terms of her news and journalism bona fides. But, I mean, John, am I being a little too old man Mushnick here with this? I think what really turned me off at the last Olympics was just seeing Billy Bush caping so bad for Ryan Lochte.
I mean, I think you're being a little bit old manish. I think at the end of the day, it is a primetime television series that they're trying to get as big an audience as possible. Where I think that you're correct, though, is that, you know, how can you stand in Seoul, South Korea, and not mention some of the politics of that region and not sort of go in on it on some of the politics of that region? And so I'm going to be very interested to see if they leave it to, you know, NBC News, which will play it straight, or if they're going to have somebody like Casas that would come in and give a, you know, give a real political op-ed almost on air that that would undoubtedly create headlines back over there and back here, like he did in Russia, like he did in China, like he did just about everywhere else.
Neil? Well, I think today's showization is a good, if that is in fact a word, is a good way to put it, because if you're gonna make the argument I just made about, hey, people just want to watch a sports competition, so we don't need the politics, obviously by the same logic, you don't want them to go the other way with the and make it just this happy, you know morning show TV series either. Like, if we're gonna try to stay away from the outside stuff, let's not put a happy face on it or obsess about the geopolitical stuff, and let's treat it like a sports event. So in that sense, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, you don't want to have too much happy talk if you're going to have an absence of danger talk. I will say that at that, the news of the North and South Korea walking into the opening ceremonies together happened to break the day of that NBC presser last Wednesday at 30 Rock to talk about the Olympics. And it was when I talked to Jim Bell, president of NBC Olympics, about that. And they were, you know, there was no question that the NBC people, even just in terms of the angst level of their employees, were very happy to see the temperature coming down on that whole situation over there relative to a month or two ago, where it really looked like, you know, I mean, it's still scary, I realize, but at least the temperature's come down a little.
Little, yeah.
NBC hospitality, a lot of them aren't even going to be in Korea because of those fears, Neil. They're going to be in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, watching on big screens there.
Right, and they lost. There were a lot of clients. I mean, I covered Rio. I'm sorry, I covered. I covered Sochi, and that was a big issue in Sochi, where you just did not see a lot of American corporate and NBC's clients heading out. I know John has covered Olympics too. Yeah, I will say this, and I think all of us like talking to Jim Bell. He's a bright guy. My God, that guy, he, with his Today Show background, that's he's adding to the Today Showization of all this. And I will leave you guys with this in my exhibit A, B, and C. Who is the late night host for the Rio Olympics? Ryan Seacrest. So John is correct. It is in the end an entertainment show. I realize I'm filibustering here, but I'll finish my filibuster, Neil, and then you can go. I know it's an entertainment show, but when you go to other countries and you watch this stuff, you watch the BBC coverage, you watch the CBC coverage, they don't have the Ryan Seacrest of the world in these kind of positions. They cover it like a sporting event. NBC covers this like a television show.
I'd almost suggest that maybe the best model for this type of the coverage of this type of event is more what we've seen from the recent World Cups, where you acknowledge you're in another country and this is a big event, you do some cultural stuff, but primarily it's about a sports tournament. And, you know, that might be the way to go. The Olympics has always been so tied into politics in a way the World Cup hasn't been as much.
Right.
Maybe that's the way to sort of think about it.
All right. Is there anything else you guys want to talk about on the Olympics before we head on here? Well, because there's going to be more time to talk about the Olympics when the Olympics is going on.
Right. Well, just in terms of I did ask all those guys about the hockey situation, and, you know, just real quickly about the lack of NHL. If that hodgepodge of an American team does well, you know, people are going to watch the medal round of the hockey tournament because most casual fans don't know who the American NHL stars anyway. So I do think there's some hope for that hockey tournament if the Americans do something.
All right, two things there. One, there's a phone in the background. Which one of you guys was that?
I'm sorry.
I just want to know.
It's me, okay? It's me. I'm a busy man.
I like natural sounds. It's fine. We'll never cut it. And two, John Oren. I mean, did Neil Best just give a promo for NBC's Olympics hockey coverage? I mean, the guy the guy might as well be Chris McCloskey or Greg Hughes trying to spin how the hockey tournament is going to be so fabulous.
If the Americans don't know,
it should be a lot meaner, I thought.
If the Americans go on a run, people will watch.
Not as many people are going to watch that as they did if the NHL players went on a run.
Chance. But how many people had heard of the players in 1980 on the team until they went on a run?
Listen.
A little different situation.
Yeah,
okay,
I mean, we all love 1980, but come on. It's been a long
time. Okay. All right. I'm a hockey fan.
I'm not. I obviously will watch it. I'm not I'm not getting in. To me, the real hockey tournament is the women's hockey tournament. That's the one I'm interested in.
Because
those games are going to be, at least when U.S. plays Canada, those games are going to be fantastic. All right, John Orand, Last week, you were reporting out who was going to bid on Thursday Night Football. And you initially were reporting that you had been tipped that you thought ABC was going to bid, meaning that if ABC got the bid, it'd be the first time we had seen NFL games on ABC, obviously through the prism of ESPN and Disney, in more than a decade. But now, and this will break after this podcast comes out, you have learned, John, as you told me before we started taping this, that ABC will not bid on this.
Well, the NFL expected ABC to bid. ABC, ESPN executives expected to submit a bid, and at the 11th hour, they just decided that the cost that they saw, they couldn't find a way to profitability. So they decided that the rights fee was too high, and they did not bid. Turner Sports also, for the first time since Thursday Night Football has been opened up, they decided not to bid. So from the TV side, CBS, Fox, and NBC are the three TV networks that are jostling for it, and it's going to be from what I'm told, and I mean this is all sort of anonymously sourced as they're negotiating, but from what I'm told, Fox's bid is the most attractive of the three, so it's going to be pretty interesting to see if Thursday Night Football goes to Fox.
All right, so I want to stay with you on this since you've been ahead of everybody on this reporting. What does that mean then if Fox gets Thursday Night Football? How do they play this with whatever their schedule is now, and what kind of involvement theoretically could FS1 have in that?
FS1, almost no involvement. I mean, the NFL has been very clear about they want this to go to a broadcast network. Also, I don't want to suggest that this is definitely going to Fox because, you know, they can renegotiate with the other networks. And also, one thing the NFL has proven with Thursday Night Football is that they don't always go for the highest bidder. So sometimes, you know, Amazon didn't put in the highest bid and Amazon got it. I don't think Twitter put in the highest bid and Twitter got it. So
right.
So they really view this as like an experiment, and there are many different reasons or ways they would go get it. But it would be all on Fox. It would be one of Fox's top teams, probably not Buck and Aikman, although that still would be to be decided.
Right.
And it's gonna be interesting too because Fox is the NFC partner. The NFC has the bigger markets and sort of better games. And could they decide, hey, instead of having this on Sunday, why don't we get this Sunday 4 o'clock game? Why don't we take Eagles Cowboys and put it on Thursday night instead? So they could really mix and match a lot differently with their own games there potentially.
You know, as many moving parts as there are with that Thursday night thing, and, there's various motivations and money and et cetera, just strictly as a viewing experience, they could overcome a significant chunk of the Thursday night problem by just getting that thing on one network, because it's my job to follow this stuff, and half the time I can't remember what channel I'm supposed to turn to on Thursday night. So I think they could really help that package by having some kind of continuity.
It's true, and in fact, this package is so unique with the NFL, where fans seem to hate it, the TV networks don't love it, advertisers aren't supporting it as hard as they once did. I mean, if you were the NFL, it's not that much money for the NFL. Why not just kind of throw everything back into Sunday and pare it back down to what they need to put on to the NFL Network?
John.
You know, I mean, but they do want a lot of people to sample this, and they see this as a golden goose for when their rights are up in 2021, 2022.
John, do you think if regardless of if Fox gets it or if CBS, NBC retain or one of the networks retains, do you think they're going to continue with the idea of divisional rivalries, or you think they'll change that and maybe just change what the paradigm of Thursday Night Football has been for the last couple of years in terms of the teams?
You know, Thursday Night Football Sunday Night Football is their big marquee primetime package, and so they want the best games on Sunday Night Football. Thursday Night Football never quite has been that way, but now that it's on broadcast television, it leads off the NFL weekend, and so the idea of putting a poor game, poor quality game, or a little watch game on Thursday night is I don't see that happening. I see them putting more divisional matchups and higher quality games on Thursday nights.
But as much pushback as they get from the players about how dangerous Thursday night games is, if they ever change this idea that, okay, each team only has to do it once a year, that's only going to ratchet up that criticism. At least now they can say, all right, whatever, you know, everybody does it once a year. You'll just deal with it.
All right, we'll get back to our conversation with John Orand and Neil Best in 1 second. But let's talk about Mattress Firm. We all know the importance of getting a good night's sleep, right? Well, guys and gals, let me tell you about Mattress Firm. Let's keep the ball rolling, shall we? The base for my argument is simple. Your bed budget can go further when you're shopping at America's Neighborhood Mattress Store. It's a true home run, and you'll have a ball. They're the head coaches when it comes to mattress expertise, but know this. They are more than mattress experts. They have a game plan that helps you transform your mattress into a bed, from adjustable bases and sheets to headboards and bedroom decor. They have you literally and figuratively covered up like your favorite cornerback. Go to mattressfirm.com/podcast to see what deals are happening as I read this sentence to you. They even offer you a 120-night sleep trial to ensure perfection and a 120-night low-price guarantee so you know you paid the perfect price. Talk about a 1-2 punch, a knockout, if you will. Score big with a perfect bed. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast to get the play-by-play on how you can monumentally improve your sleep tonight, today, and tomorrow. All right, we'll shift gears, and we'll cover this very, very quickly. Last week, there was a story from Deadline Hollywood that had Jeff Zucker reportedly being considered for the ESPN job. I think there was then another trade publication who picked up on that. That struck me as kind of an absurdity on many reasons, and this is why I loved John Orand, deep from the cheap seats, tweeting out, "I've talked to somebody who would know, and this is nonsense." So, John, I want to get to you. You know, I always think to myself, these things sort of happen because somebody wants that out there because it helps leverage positions. I don't have a specific evidence as to who might have done that, but there's always reasons why we see leaks sometimes as to names being attached to certain jobs. But what did your reporting eventually show you? Because the idea, one, that ESPN would go or Disney would go to an outsider with no experience negotiating with professional sports leagues, with no experience in terms of sports programming, with no experience in terms of the relationships that you need in that world, and not part of the Disney and or ESPN hierarchy, just struck me as like just an absurdity. Your thoughts here.
Well, you know, if this was like a one-off, if it was just one publication, you could just say, you know what, it's a reporter that got some wires crossed and messed up. But this really seemed coordinated. There were, you know, two publications, both based in Hollywood, came out with an identical story. Their source definitely did not come from Burbank, I can tell you. And it really, all it took was like one phone call to you know, Disney or to ESPN just to you know, make it a bigger, better story, I would think. So, I made a call almost immediately when I saw the story because I viewed it as just as fantastic as you did. I mean, I was incredulous when I was reading it. It got knocked down very quickly, and so I went out with a tweet, which again, like, you know, reporters make mistakes. I generally don't like to do that, but that tweet was like wildfire, and I just thought that it was important to get out. But, you know, these guys have never talked. Iger and Zucker have never talked about it, and as far as I know, like, Zucker really, you know, isn't viewed anywhere inside Disney as a potential replacement for Skipper.
Yeah, but you know, listen, all of us, it's happened to all of us. Sometimes you get bad sourcing. Sometimes the source gives you you know, really bad tip. But yeah, John, this was odd in that it almost felt a little trial balloonish that it got put out there. I mean, since then, we've obviously had CNN spokespeople deny it. We've had, I don't know if we've had Disney deny it, but, you know, we've had reporters who cover that world say that's not the case. Neil, just from your...
Actually, Richard, can I sound like an old man for a second?
Yeah, go ahead.
This news cycle that we have right now, that story published right around like 5 o'clock on a Friday, And then I got pushed back around 6 o'clock on a Friday and then got completely sort of dismissed by 7 o'clock on a Friday. This news cycle took 2 hours, and we're still talking about it, and it's still sort of the talk of the beat. But it's amazing how quick that cycle worked.
Well, here's what I might just counter back, John, and say I'm not sure how like quickly it got knocked down. I mean, I see a story on CNN. CNN boss Jeff Zucker may be in the mix for the ESPN job. So, like, a legitimate – now, obviously, I realize the connection between Zucker and CNN. But, you know, so these trade publications come out with this, and then there's a story analyzing the possibility of it. So we did get – I felt like we got a little bit more of a news cycle in terms – you know, regarding something that clearly doesn't seem to be – seem to have any merit. Neil, did you want to – add anything?
Only that I think Richard Deitch would be a perfect choice for that job.
You think so?
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to see that. I'm gonna report that later today.
Excellent. Yeah, I don't have a lot of experience negotiating.
You'll figure it out. You'd be good on the content end.
Yeah, the content end I feel like maybe I can handle, but John, would that be a raise for me, you think? I think it might be. Huh?
Wow. I know what reporters make, Richard. Yeah, you'd get a raise.
I'm thinking that could be – I want. You know what's really great, though?
You could be LaPlaca's assistant and get a raise, Richard.
Ooh, wow.
It's Chris LaPlaca.
You could too, Neil. I'm just saying.
Probably true.
I would probably sooner move to Latvia at an ice rink before I'm working for LaPlaca. But what I always find, like, this is very, very, very inside baseball here, but the thing that is, like, really good for these ESPN execs, John, you know this, is don't they have this, like, special stock program where it's, like, the high, high executives that they can, like, I believe, like, to get Kevin Merida out of the Washington Post, who's, like, one of the great editors in this country, they had to, like, float this, like, famous Disney kind of stock plan that executives can get in. Do you know more about this than me? But it's supposed to be like, you know, it's like if you get in on this, you're going to be buying a second house on the Jersey Shore like very soon.
I don't know much about this, actually. I'm listening intently.
This requires some further research.
See if you guys can do that. I'm fairly certain that there's like an executive kind of stock comp. I think it's like a Disney stock compensation, but it's really like crazy, like, you know, big potential big money. And that's how you can – that's how I feel like you can seal the deal when you're trying to get somebody to come into the executive branch at ESPN. Although, they're not going to do that with executives, and they'll save that money for John Gruden's replacement, right? I mean, you gotta have an analyst at a certain point. You guys, I've stopped this podcast.
We stopped it in our track. What else are we going to talk about? Are we talking about gymnastics?
We'll get to gymnastics, but last one on the ESPN thing as I'll finish
all
up
right.
is, and you guys are welcome to comment on, I have a story coming out later this week about talking to Stephanie Drewley, who is in charge of their remote production talent and studio talent, and keep your eye on Matt Hasselbeck for the John Gruden replacement. That's all I'll say. It's not been decided. It's not going to be decided till the spring, but if Matt Hasselbeck has a very good Pro Bowl, would not be surprised if he could solidify that.
And I think there's no reason to think he can't do that job well. I mean, based on what I've heard, so I guess we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
RD, rank your top three. Who are the next three to sort of take a look at that job?
Well, I think obviously this is not going to happen. But if somehow Peyton Manning could be interested in this, they'd roll up the Brinks truck. But, yeah, zero chance. On top of the fact, no disrespect to our, the fine people listening and, at the Bristol Kids Center. But Peyton Manning could have any job he wants in NFL broadcasting, maybe except the Tony Romo job right now. And so those other jobs are better than the ESPN job. They would create a better job for him in terms of scheduling. And so that's not going to happen. And then, John, I think I would go to Hasselbeck right now, number two, just given he has the assignment for the Pro Bowl. And then, like, my number three, not including Peyton, or, like, let's just make it 2-3, I think it's going to be in-house people. I think, like the Randy Mosses, the Lewis Riddicks, people sort of in that circle, because I don't think that ESPN wants to pay a ton of money for someone on the outside when there is no slam dunk pick. Do you concur with that, John, or what's your thought?
Yeah, I see it as being somebody internal, and I think that the way that they view their NFL programming is that they have so many people getting so many reps and so many studio shows that if they can't find somebody that can step into the Monday Night Football booth, then they're doing something wrong. And I think that's sort of internally how they're viewing everything.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead.
You can say the same thing about baseball too, right? I mean, they have this. You know, stable of people. Like, you should be able to find good people for play-by-play or analyst jobs.
Yeah, it was interesting. I don't know if you guys saw. Did you catch Dave Fleming basically saying he was out of having a chance at the A job? And which just confirms, I think, what we've all known, that that job is going to John Shambi or Carl Ravitch. I thought Carl Ravitch, and probably still think he was the favorite for that, just given his long tenure, and he has, you know, he knows the people very long time making that decision. John Shambi, of course, probably is the more pure baseball broadcaster. But I think, without a shadow of a doubt, one of those two guys is Dan Shulman's replacement.
But I think I tweeted this out at some point, but at this point, for the Sunday Night Baseball and Monday Night Football, Jessica Mendoza has the most seniority of any ESPN play-by-play or analyst person on those two shows. So
that's crazy. John, do you think, I mean, this isn't going to happen, but do you think 2018 would be a better year if you were going to try like a Dennis Miller, Tony Kornheiser move, as compared to when you did it the last time?
I don't know. I think that they've learned from that. I think that, you know, people want analysts that sort of talk about the sport and talk about the game in front of them, not sort of, you know, telling jokes and not sort of like talking like stream of consciousness. Jeff Van Gundy being sort of a notable exception to that.
By the way, you know what's great is, here's two great things. Do you remember when the ESPN PR department used to try to like, spin or get mad of us when we criticize like bringing Christian Slater into the booth for the Monday Night Football interview? Yep. When they had that run, that's one that really does not, you know, sort of wear well historically. The other one is, and this is great, and I like to get on LaPlaca and Krulowitz and the rest of that team for this. For so many years, those guys made it a point to say, we don't push First Take hard. Yes, it's one of our shows, but we're not going over the top. We're much more happier pushing outside the lines, etc. First Take has become the bell of the ball for them. They promote that, you know, the way Guy Fieri promotes eating hamburgers. I mean, they cannot love that more now. And how the tides have changed, because obviously First Take for them, when it comes to their daytime programming, is their biggest winner.
The one positive memory I have of the having celebrities in the booth era, though, is every time I think about Jimmy Kimmel asking Theismann how's the leg, I do chuckle. That was the one moment where I thought it was funny.
But he was by far and away the best guest. And what happened, right, if you remember, immediately after? They banned him from the booth.
I know, but that was a great, perfectly delivered line.
It was great. Yeah, actually, Jimmy Kimmel, if I remember, was very kind enough. This is obviously before Jimmy Kimmel really, really blew up. I talked to him, I think, the day after. Was it Jay Rothman who banned him, or was it Hire or Skipper?
I don't know.
Yeah. Jimmy, but, you know, everybody. First of all, everybody who gets banned from ESPN at one point comes back. Jim Miller was banned before he wrote the big book on them, and then he was, well, now he's, now they love him more than anyone.
Yeah. So yes. What was Jim Miller banned for?
Jim Miller was, when he was doing the ESPN book, they banned him from going to campus because they were freaking out that he was talking to a lot of people and obviously getting stuff. And, you know, they could not figure out what the PR strategy was. And then eventually, because they knew he was, you know, or he said, listen, I'm doing this book no matter what, they eventually sort of opened the door up a little bit, you know, because they got to the point where they knew, like, you know, you can either have an author do the book and you have no connection to it, or you can have an author do the book and maybe you can try to shape a little bit of it as best you can. So they made the latter decision. But they banned him from going to Bristol at least for a couple weeks.
No kidding.
Yeah, and Michael Hiestand famously banned, right, by NBC Sports after he knocked Dick Ebersol on a Toronto radio station.
On a Canadian radio show, right.
Wow, and Michael Kay let me in his studio on Friday. He's much more open-minded.
Have you either of you guys been banned by any PR departments that you've covered during your career?
I was back in the day, Fox Sports put me on ice, so to speak, which, of course, made it so that I then wrote about Fox every week for about probably 8 straight weeks.
Yeah, I've never been banned, but certainly the LaPlaca land turned me down at one point 9 times for one of their execs. And this Stephanie Drouin interview broke the streak of 12 declines for executives. So that's not a total freeze, but it was interesting. Neil, so I guess you're just a likable guy. Nobody
does.
Michael Strahan at least a half a dozen times told me he never talked to me again, and I don't know, Francesa did several times. So it hasn't been PR people, but people on my beats have told me they'll never talk to me again, and then eventually did.
Wow, so there you go. So Michael Kay calls you Neil Wurst, and yet Francesa's banning you. Unbelievable.
I was in the past, but I'm not currently banned, and Strahan's bans were back in the late 90s, so it's, you know, now I'm fine with Strahan because, you know, I'm not covering him as a player anymore.
You know Mushnick's missing Francesa. I mean, it changes the entire complexion of the column. I know
there's definitely a hole there. Yeah, but Francesa says he's coming back to do something in April. There'll be opportunities.
Francesa's been on Simmons' podcast.
He's been on Simmons, NFL Network, Barstool. He's all over the place.
All right, let us do two more topics here. John, did you want to say something?
Nope, I'm good.
No, okay. I was going to say something about gymnastics, but you set it up.
Yeah, let me set it up. So this is I want to get your take on this because it's most important story in my opinion last week in terms of sports were what we saw out of Lansing, Michigan. More than 100 survivors testified at a 4-day sentencing hearing for former Michigan State University Dr. Larry Nassar. We saw incredibly powerful victim impact statements from some, you know, obviously very famous gymnasts, as well as some women we had never heard of. More than 140 women and girls said Nassar abused them. In November, he pleaded guilty to 10 counts of first-degree sexual conduct with minors. It's an absolutely it's a despicable, disturbing, horrific story. And so here's where that's sort of the setup, and this is where I want to start. And I'll start with you, Neil. The place that really, I think, started this was the Indianapolis Star, who in 2016, they had this lengthy investigation into USA Gymnastics and its handling of sexual abuse complaints over decades. And it's very clear that USA Gymnastics enabled this type of behavior to happen, and it's pretty gross to read that investigation. But not until this week, at least in my opinion, or last week, did we see this story get the national attention? It finally did, and we saw some amazing investigations from ESPN's John Barr and Dan Murphy. Katie Strang of The Athletic wrote some incredible pieces. Dan Wetzel was there. Kim Kozlowski of the Detroit News. It finally felt like, Neil, that like the country paid attention. So I guess I would ask you, why did it take this long for this story to get that kind of national attention?
Yeah, it's a bizarre. Well, I mean, this is just a journalistic observation. Obviously, aside from the particulars of the story, speak for themselves. But it's the only the strange thing about it is that you have this. I think it's tied to the phenomenon of you have this sport that for 2 weeks every 4 years is arguably the biggest sport in the country, and then it goes away, and then it comes back 4 years later for 2 weeks. So given the magnitude of how much attention that sport gets for those 2 weeks, and some of these star athletes have gotten, you know, Biles and Raceman, all these people, the fact that this thing going on could be ignored for that long is a journalistic failing, of course, and a failing on the part of the public for not sort of focusing on it, I guess. But I think it's, in a weird way, it's tied to the phenomenon of the sport itself, which just goes away from our consciousness for all those in-between years.
That's well said. And listen, we're all guilty of this, including my place. John, what are your thoughts on this? Because I think Neil hit it on the head. I think journalism failed until the last couple of weeks on this story, with the exception of obviously the Indianapolis Star and maybe the Lansing State Journal and some other places.
Yeah, I mean, this was a week that people went on record talking about it. So you're going to get it's going to fly a lot more then, especially when you're sort of dealing with these types of details. Like for a journalistic enterprise, I mean, it's failed, of course. There's no denying that. We're starting from there, but it gets so much harder to verify some of these claims and get it to where it's reporting. But this week, you had some of the most gut-wrenching testimony that, you know, what was easy to cover, and it was covered very, very easily and well, I thought.
Where do you guys stand on, because I think there were some people on Twitter who were talking about this, and I think if you're not in the business, I think it's a fair question to ask. Where do you guys stand on, like, people like Tom Izzo and other prominent Michigan State coaches being asked about this? It's not their sport, but yet they are major prominent figures within that athletic department. Neil, where do you see that in terms of the journalist role asking Izzo, and then in terms of writing about what Izzo said, both in terms of straight news and analysis of what he said?
Well, I mean, even if these guys are not, you know, accountable for knowing something and not saying it, in terms of their role as spokesman for a community, I mean, let's face it, whether you're Tom Izzo or Mike Krzyzewski or Nick Saban, I mean, these are people who are more well-known and powerful than the governors of their states. So I think they have every right to ask them for a take, and then they should say something along the lines of what the governor would have said if you asked him or her, and say, this is terrible and we have to do better, and whatever they're supposed to say. But, I mean, they're fair game as incredibly prominent members of their communities.
Yeah, these guys are, you know, they weren't born yesterday. You know, Tom Izzo has been in this position for decades. He has to know that these questions are coming. He's probably the highest paid state employee in Michigan, or certainly in the top three. And you know, he should have developed a better way to answer the question than he did. I think across the board, if you're a high-profile person in, you know, representing the institution, you have to expect those questions, I would
say. I mean, if you're the assistant lacrosse coach, you don't need to be expected to have an answer for these questions. But, yeah, these guys at the tops of the football and basketball programs, they're obviously they're public figures, but they're beyond public figures. They're major community leaders.
One more for you on this topic, and I'll stick with you, Neil. Where is NBC's responsibility here in discussing this story during the Olympic Games, given the fact that some of the women who came forward were Olympic gold medalists who appeared on ESPN, on NBC's airwaves, and far more to the point, the Carolis, where a lot of these women trained and where Larry Nassar obviously worked and seemingly committed some of these horrific crimes. They were a major and have been a major part of the USA Gymnastics story that NBC has played to the hilt. I mean, in terms of the drama of these women, you know, the positive stuff, you know, naming them after they win the gold medals. If NBC doesn't cover this, to me, that's journalistic malpractice during the games.
Which games are you talking about, 2018 or 2020?
2018. I realize it's not the Summer Olympics, but you rode with this. You rode with the positives of the gymnastics team and them winning all these gold medals and the great glory shots of Carrie Strug and Michaela Maroney. And now there is a real journalistic story about the Carolis and this guy Larry Nassar. Why would you not at some point cover it, even though, yes, I understand gymnastics are not part of this cycle, but you are the home of the Olympics in the country.
I guess, but the Olympics are still a couple weeks, three weeks away. I mean, the NBC News should be covering that like right now. So I don't know if, you know, I guess you could argue they should do a report on it during the Olympics, but more to the point, the report is like now.
Okay, well, I agree with that.
But in terms of your arguing that, let's say NBC has a little bit, you know, more of a responsibility to cover it today than the other networks, I mean, I think you can make that case.
I didn't make my point well. I think that's what I was trying to say. John?
Where would you have them report on this? During, like, an ice skating competition? During the downhill?
It's a good question. I don't know. I need to think about that. But there's a lot of interstitial kind of like places where they go from event to event, particularly in prime time. So I think there are places where Mike Tirico can come in, and if he doesn't want to get into that content, he could certainly bring in the reporters or do a piece that reports on this. I don't know. Maybe I'm totally wrong here, and I will respect if you disagree with me, but I feel like given how much they have propped the positives of gymnastics, they owe it to their audience to talk about the underbelly of the sport too.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I haven't thought this through, so I'm not sure how I feel on it. If this were the Summer Olympics, I think I'd be much more inclined to agree with you.
Okay, that's fair. I'm not saying. Listen, I'm not saying I'm right. It's just something I want to throw out there. All right, let's finish with this. This again is something that happened north of us, but I wanted to touch on this because, you know, it's rare that we see people in 2018 like sort of be tabbed as sports writing legends, but Red Fisher was that. He was, as my old colleague Michael Farber wrote, the conscience of Montreal hockey. He died Friday at age 91. He covered the Canadiens. He started on the Canadiens beat in 1955 and finished it in 2012. He taught generations of fans in Montreal about the Canadiens, probably about the sport. He covered 43 of the last 45 Stanley Cups before he retired. Neil, will we ever see somebody have the kind of impact that Red Fisher did with the written word, or is that guys like Red Fisher basically just like their relics of a different time when like the newspaper columnist, the sports columnist, could be like a god in a city?
Yeah, well, obviously, just in the strictly written form, yes, that generation is going away, and he was a major sort of example of that. I mean, obviously, journalists will continue to have impact moving forward, and you know, in a multiple role that hopefully includes writing, but is not exclusively writing. But you know, obviously, in his case, it's tied into the what that sport means to that country, and also the whole you know language dynamic of writing. You know, in a place where you know there are two languages, and you have to make an impact in one of them. And so, yeah, obviously, he's part of a fading generation that could have that kind of that could be even remembered in this way strictly for writing. I mean, I assume 30, 40 years from now, as journalists are pass away and are remembered, it's not going to be too many of them who are remembered just as writers like guys from his era can be.
Yeah, John, I was thinking to myself, who is the most prominent hockey writer in America? And there's not an automatic obvious answer.
No, in fact, Puck Daddy or something? I mean,
I think he's Canadian too, Greg Wyshynski. But yeah, I mean, they're
that's probably the right answer though, Puck Daddy.
It might be the right answer, but what does that say? I mean, that's kind of interesting in that there's like, you know, in football, I think it's a little sort of there's multiple people, you know, if you go like the Peter Kang route or you can go the Rappaport Schefter route, but like it's interesting. There's no Red Fisher in American writing hockey circles right now. And it speaks to, obviously, the time that we live in, I think.
Well, but also, you have to, in fairness, you can't compare it necessarily. You can't go by hockey. I mean, in our country, football and baseball are the equivalent that hockey is up there. So
right.
You'd have to look at baseball writers or whatever.
I would say the NBA over baseball.
Yeah, no, okay, fine. But, you know, it's not – I mean, hockey in this country is it's a different thing. So the bigger point is, yeah, to have a guy that influential and respected, et cetera, you know, yeah, he's from a – dying generation, literally.
Wow, Neil, what a I mean, what took,
I mean, it's
took
what
the podcast
in
a hell of a depressing turn.
I mean, things happen in life. So what do you? I didn't set up this system.
By the way, as I'm reading the Sports Business Daily breaking, as we are taping this at noon on Monday, and Josh Weinfuss of ESPN.com reporting that. I believe he covers the Cardinals, the Arizona Cardinals. Recently retired Cardinals coach Bruce Arians said he is interested in replacing John Gruden as the color analyst in the booth, but he doesn't think the feelings are mutual.
He's got personality, that's for sure.
I'd be interested. I don't think they're interested in me. I think Bruce Arians is a fun guy, but I think if you're ESPN, I don't think you think he is the guy to walk right from the coaching booth and into the broadcast booth.
Listen, there's one person in the history of television just about who's done that, and that's Tony Romo this year. So I would find it very surprising to see ESPN give its biggest brand
Agreed.
To somebody that's a broadcasting neophyte like Bruce.
Now, I would say this. There is one person, I think, in the NFL who is coaching where I think they might be willing to roll it. And who would that be if he walked away from the game?
Bill Belichick.
Exactly. That's the one guy who
kidding.
listen, he made you. I think they would. First of all, I think Bill is a lot better behind closed doors than he is obviously in the press, and you'll see that in the upcoming 30 for 30. But if Bill Belichick, let's say, happened to be saying if we win this year, I'm going to retire. You don't think ESPN executives Neil would be calling him in a second?
They'd be very interested in exploring that. But I don't know how that would
John.
Go.
I think they'd hire him in a second.
To be
yes.
Like the Monday Night Football analyst.
Yes, John, be with me here, John. Come on.
I'm gonna side with Neil on this.
Come
I'm
on,
sorry,
John.
Already.
Where is your creativity here?
Wow. I mean, maybe have it in a three-man booth. How about as part of it? That I could see, maybe.
With who? You got you need a
player. Well, I don't know, Randy, just him and McDonough. I don't know. Wow.
How about Jimmy Garoppolo, Bill Belichick, and Sean McDonough calling games? I'd love that. All right, listen, we've said so much, but yet maybe we haven't said anything at all. Is there anything else that we need to cover on this week's roundtable?
That doesn't have to do with New York radio?
With Neil Best and John Arnold. I think I feel like, John, who should I, John, help me out here. Who should I book the roundtable after the Super Bowl? I have to get Chad Finn, obviously, because the Patriots
are. Got to get Chad Finn, and then we got to think who's a
Do
good
I go
Philly?
For you? Do I go for Trina? Do I go for Neil Best? Do I go for Jim Miller?
Didn't Stephen A. Smith work for the Inquirer at one time?
Well, he's not covering sports media, though.
There's got to be some cranky Philadelphia media types you can put on to represent.
This is not the sports reporters. It's a specialty podcast. I need people who write or talk about sports media.
Oh, right.
So I can't bring on. That's the Mitch Albom, Mike
Lupica. With Chad Finn.
Yeah, that's the Mitch Albom, Mike Lupica show. I have to have people cover this. I'll think about it. But there's Rob Tourneau covers media in Philly. Does that name ring a bell to you guys?
My wife
covers
Philly.
I think he does some sports media stuff for Philly.com. He might be.
I don't live that far. Just real quick, I mean, one of the things I thought about, you talk about this being New York's worst nightmare. You know, in most of the country, if you had people living an hour away from a team that's in the Super Bowl, obviously you're all caught up and that's your home team.
Right.
It's just an amazing phenomenon with New York and Philly and to a lesser extent Boston that, you know, I live an hour and 15 minutes from Philly, and that is a completely different world. The fact that they're in the Super Bowl is no different than if it was the Vikings. And it's just a weird dynamic of, you know, how close together we all are here.
Does the NFL fan in Phoenix, Arizona, are they getting into this game, or do you have to be east of the Mississippi River?
I mean, it's the Super Bowl. It's fine. It's the Patriots. These are big brands.
Neil Best is the sports general columnist and the sports media writer for Newsday. John Orand is the sports media writer for Sports Business Journal and Sports Business Daily. John and Neil, thank you very much for joining the Sports Illustrated podcast this week, and I will have you guys back soon. Thank you again.
Always a pleasure, RD.
Okay.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to John Orand and Neil Best, and thank you to Lou Pellegrino for producing this. Previous podcasts, the last couple of weeks, Jim Nance is the last long form we did, and he was great. 84-minute conversation about working with Tony Romo, his current relationship with Phil Simms, how he prepares for the Final Four and the Masters and NFL postseason. I think you're really going to enjoy that. Katie Nolan, Jemele Hill, Mike Francesa, Tara Lipinski, and Johnny Weir. Those are the last one-on-ones. And then we have some roundtables that I think you might enjoy, including Being 30 and Under in the Sports Media, where SB Nation writer Charlotte Wilder, SI.com writer Dan Gartland, and Awful Announcing writer Andrew Buchholz talked about what it's like to be under 30 in this business and to try to forge out a career at a time when jobs are tough and jobs that pay well are certainly tough. So please check those out. That is on the SI Media Podcast with Richard Deitch. Head over to Apple Podcasts. If you like it, please subscribe and leave a review. We're also on Google Play and Stitcher. All right, for Lou Pellegrino, for everybody Cage 13, for everybody at Sports Illustrated, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.